Welcome everybody. Today we have a lot of material to cover. Remember, if M is the manifold, then we found a way to address each individual point on the manifold, namely by using a chart. A chart is a map from a patch of the manifold, or even the entire manifold, into Rn. And in this way, every point of the manifold, such as the point P, will be assigned a point in Rn, but points in Rn are labeled by n numbers, and therefore we have a labeling system for every point on the manifold. Now, how do we define the tangent spaces? How do we define the tangent space to a point? We'll start with the tangent space to a point, and then we will consider all of the tangent spaces later. But for now, let's just construct a tangent space to one point. We will call that tangent space TP of M. M the manifold, T for tangent space, and P for the particular point where we are interested in the tangent space. So how can we define the tangent space to a differentiable manifold at a point P? The intuition is clear. We have the manifold, we have a point P, and then the tangent space is somehow a plane attached to the point of the manifold, and the dimension of that tangent space is supposed to match the dimension of the manifold. So far, the intuition. But how can we actually define that from first principles? There are three equivalent ways of defining the tangent space to a manifold at a point. The first one is the algebraic definition. It's actually historically the last one, but for us it'll be the first. It is the most modern, the most powerful way of defining what the tangent space at a point is. The algebraic definition of the tangent space is based on two profound ideas. The first idea is that the tangent space, that a tangent vector can be identified with the directional derivative. Let's think about that for a moment. What does that mean? If you have a function of one variable, then there's only one notion of derivative. You differentiate it or you don't, but there's only one kind, the derivative. But when you have a function over Rn, then you can differentiate in any direction you want. It's the directional derivative. So for every direction, you have a directional derivative. And every directional derivative implies a direction. So the first idea is to identify tangent vectors with directional derivatives. There's one directional derivative for every direction you can point to, and vice versa. So the idea is to identify tangent vectors with directional derivatives. We say they are directional derivatives. But what do we gain by doing that? We gain by doing that we can now identify tangent vectors by identifying directional derivatives. So we've reduced the problem of finding out what tangent vectors are in tangent space to finding what directional derivatives are. And the second profound insight that goes into the definition, the algebraic definition of the tangent spaces, is that derivatives can be defined without coordinates. You don't need variables for that. You don't need coordinate systems to define derivatives. There's a more abstract, more powerful way to define derivatives. Namely, derivatives obey the Leibniz rule. Also, directional derivatives obey the Leibniz rule. And we can identify the derivatives, the first derivative, as everything that obeys that. This is so much more powerful than using a coordinate system and any Newton-Leibniz limit of epsilon going to zero, difference between functions, and so on. You need none of that. Just the Leibniz rule on its own, the product rule for differentiation, is structure enough to fix, to identify derivatives, and therefore all directional derivatives. And once we've identified them in a coordinate system independent way, in a more powerful way, then we can identify what the tangent vectors are, because we say the tangent vectors are the directional derivatives. The business with the coordinate system independence will not play much of a role just yet, but later on in the course, this approach to defining derivatives, namely through a Leibniz rule, will be used quite often. It's very powerful. And then, of course, there is the physicist's definition of what the tangent space is. Here, the idea is that the elements of the tangent space to a point P are recognizable by how their components change under change of charge, under change of coordinate system. As I alluded to in the last lecture, the previous lecture, this comes with a prejudice. And we have to be careful about that. This approach has some merit, but it's limited. And then there's the geometric definition of what a tangent space is. Here, the elements of the tangent space to a point, so the tangent vectors, are identified, in this approach, they're identified as being actual tangent vectors of one-dimensional curves that run through the point P. So here's the manifold, here's the point P, and then you can run many, many different paths through that point P, and then you can differentiate the path with respect to the path parameter, like the time, and then you get vectors at the point P, and you can identify tangent vectors with those derivatives of path. So which shall we use? It turns out that the three give us the same ultimate tangent spaces, equivalent tangent spaces, but they have different uses, the three definitions, and we will need to use all three of those definitions occasionally. So we'll do all three very carefully. And today we'll start with the algebraic definition of tangent spaces. The geometric definition and the physicist definition will be much faster, probably. I mean, you'll be familiar with them, I assume. So then, how do we define tangent spaces algebraically? Remember, the idea has two parts. The first part is to identify a tangent vector with a directional derivative, because each directional derivative is singling out a particular direction, so does a tangent vector, so we want to identify them. And the second idea that goes into this definition is that derivatives are definable without the help of Newton or Leibniz. Well, actually Leibniz, yes, because this is the Leibniz rule. Just by this algebraic property, by the property that the derivative of the product of two functions is given by the product rule, we can identify what derivatives are, and we can identify all directional derivatives in this way, and therefore all the tangent vectors. A key example is the case where the manifold in question is Rn. In this case, we should recover what we know. But it's worth doing that case also, because later on we will rely on that case, also for the manifold, for the case of generic manifolds that are not necessarily Rn. So in this case, the two parts, A and B, that we talked about just now, those two, tangent vector is directional derivative. Directional derivatives can be identified as those objects that, those operations that obey the Leibniz rule. They look explicitly like this here. First, the tangent vectors xi at the point P are identified with the directional first derivatives. This is how a directional first derivative looks like on Rn. Here we have the partial derivatives, and we take linear combinations of those partial derivatives. Any linear combination that we may choose gives us a directional derivative. The whole thing is then called xi. Xi is to be a tangent vector at a point in Rn. Now, I said that these things can be identified by their algebraic properties. This is part B. The claim is that tangent vectors at the point P should be those maps that take functions into their directional derivative at a point. So a tangent vector is literally, by construction, by definition, is the evaluation map of a directional derivative at a point. A tangent vector can be fed a function. Okay, so xi maps a function into a number, namely the application of the tangent vector onto that function, and that number is the directional derivative evaluated at the point in question. So this funny structure that the tangent vector is a map originates from part A, where we say that tangent vectors are derivatives. So the idea is that the tangent vectors can be identified in this way. They are derivatives. They obey the Leibniz rule. If you apply a tangent vector, remember that's the evaluation of a directional derivative at a point. If we apply a tangent vector to the product of two functions, then we should get the tangent vector applied to the first function times the second plus the first function times the directional derivative on the second function. Just the usual Leibniz rule. Just think of xi as a derivative. Then this is the usual Leibniz rule. Now I've put this in quotation marks. See here the quotation marks? Because it's not quite right what I wrote here. It's not quite right because really a tangent vector doesn't act on functions. A tangent vector, after all, what it does is it is evaluating the directional derivative of a function at a particular point. It's not differentiating the function everywhere. A tangent vector at the point P doesn't know what the function does away from P. It only cares about its derivative at P itself. So this is really a sloppy notation here, and we have to be a little bit more precise to encode the idea that everything we do at the moment is local. We are talking about the tangent space at a particular point and about what functions do at that particular point. So how, when I write just a Q followed by an A, it means question and then right away the answer. So the question now is how to express the local nature of the tangent vector as an element of the tangent space to a point P. How do we express the locality of that properly? Technically, xi acts on so-called function germs, not on functions. This may be a new concept to you. What is a function germ rather than a function? A function germ is the essence of a function at a point when you don't care what the functions do elsewhere. Here's the full definition. It's actually a little more general than we need it at the moment. But we might as well do it in full generality. So far we've looked at functions on Rn, which map, you know, Rn into R, for example. But for the purpose of defining what a function germ is, let us not look at functions from Rn into R, but more generally, into functions that map one differentiable manifold into another differentiable manifold. Examples are, of course, Rn into R. But it could be Rn into Rn or just some curved space-time into some other multidimensional space. Okay, so assume that M and N are differentiable manifolds. And assume that P is a point in M. This is where we want to define later on the tangent space. And this is where we now want to understand what the function germ is. So consider now two functions that map from M into N. We will form equivalence classes of them. Function germs are really equivalence classes of functions. So we say that two functions, phi and psi, both mapping from n to n, are germ equivalent about the point P that we are currently interested in, if there exists an open neighborhood of our point P on which both functions completely agree. Okay, so you have two functions, phi and psi, and in principle they can do very different things. But if in an open neighborhood of the point P in question, they completely agree, then we put them into the same equivalence class. This makes sense for what we need it for. See, because the directional derivative only cares what a function does locally, what it does elsewhere. How would the local directional derivative know that? So we say that two functions phi and psi are germ equivalent if they agree on some open neighborhood of the point P. So phi of q is equal to psi of q for all q in some u, which is an open neighborhood of the point P. This is an equivalence relation. So if phi 1 and phi 2 are equivalent, a germ equivalent in that sense, and phi 2 is equivalent to phi 3, then phi 1 is also equivalent to phi 3. It's an equivalence relation, and we can form equivalence classes. Each such equivalence class is called a function germ. So in order to define a function germ, you just need to give one representative of its equivalence class. Give one function, and then the remainder, the rest of all those functions in this equivalence class are defined as all those functions which agree with our starting function on some open neighborhood. So that's technically the definition of the germ. Psi is in the equivalence class of functions defined through one function phi. And that equivalence class is denoted by phi p bar. So phi is the function that we use to define the equivalence class about the point P. And the bar indicates we are looking at the equivalence class. So this whole thing is a set. It's not a function, it's a set. So psi is in this set of equivalent functions, of germ equivalent functions, if there exists an open neighborhood of the point P, such that for all q in that open neighborhood, phi of q is equal to psi of q. It's just in math notation what I said in words earlier. What we can deduce from that right away is that if phi, for example, is a differentiable map from a differentiable manifold into a differentiable manifold, if phi is differentiable at a point P, then all the other functions in its equivalence class, in its germ, possess in particular the same first derivative at P. We know that because psi is actually identical to phi in an entire open neighborhood. And you need to know a function only in a neighborhood to be able to calculate its derivative. If phi is multiple times differentiable, then so will be the functions in its germ, and they will have all the same derivatives. Okay, let's look at an example. Let's say we look at functions that map from some differentiable manifold into R. So the second manifold is now no longer just an abstract differentiable manifold, it's concretely R. So we're looking at scalar functions F. Map every point on the manifold into some number. F is mapping M into R. Then, as we said before, to specify a function germ, it suffices to specify any arbitrary one of its functions. Because then you can ask, okay, which other functions agree with this one on an open neighborhood of the point P? Well, and then the set of all germs, the set of all equivalence classes, has a name. We denote it by f of p. These are not the functions. These are the function germs. Every element of F of P is an equivalence class of functions that agree on an open neighborhood of P. It turns out that this set is not just some set of equivalence classes. It has a beautiful structure to it. Namely, these axioms hold. If F bar is such an equivalence class, if F bar is a germ, then C times F bar is the same as C times F bar, whether you first form an equivalence class and then multiply all functions with a number, or you first multiply a function and then form the equivalence class, doesn't matter. It's pretty obvious from the definition of what a germ is. And similarly, you have that whether you first multiply two functions and then construct the germ of them, or you first take the functions, take their germs, and then multiply them, all of them in equivalence classes, that's all consistent. So it doesn't matter which direction you do that. That's the multiplicativity. And this multiplication is inheriting all the nice properties of the multiplication of the algebra of all functions on the manifold. In particular, it's associative, it's commutative. And similarly with the additivity. If you remember, these are the axioms for an algebra. An algebra, just a sec, an algebra is a vector space. It has an addition and it has a multiplication. The addition is supposed to be commutative. The multiplication doesn't have to be. And there are distributive laws in between them. Any structure that obeys those axioms is called an associative algebra. The algebra of all functions of a manifold is an associative algebra. And the germs of functions about a point P also form an algebra. And I'm enumerating here the axioms as A, B, and C. We will later refer to them. There were questions. Yes?
For case B, I'm a bit confused as to what this means. So on the left, we have a set of function germs, right? And on the right, we have a set of function germs multiplying a set of function germs. What does that mean?
Well, you can do it representative-wise. You can pick a representative here and a representative there, and it's consistent. It is conceivable that such a thing might not be consistent, but it is consistent.
That's so does it mean the set of all products between one?
Yeah.
And,
okay. Mm-hmm. Right, so these axioms are inherited from the algebra structure of the algebra of all functions. So the function germs have that property. And remember, we did this because the directional derivatives at a point only see the function germs, really. They don't see anything more about the function than the function germ. Yeah.
Is there a term to describe the set of function germs? Or is it just you call it?
No, later on we will upgrade that to the algebra of functions on a manifold. Yeah. Okay, so finally we are then ready to go to the algebraic definition of the tangent space. Remember, what we really want to do here is upgrade this thing that I had in quotation marks. Remember, we said that we want to define, in the case where the manifold is Rn, in the case where the manifold is Rn, we said that one insight was that the tangent vectors can be identified. Tangent vectors at a point P can be identified with the directional first derivative. So they should be of this form. And then the next idea was that, okay, anything that's of that form should be identifiable as, should have this form here, and that should be identifiable as anything that obeys the Leibniz rule. But this was overkill here, because here we're dealing with functions, not function germs, but the directional derivatives only see the function germs. So we want to upgrade that, and this is where we are now. Okay, algebraic definition of the tangent space. Remember, the idea was the elements of the tangent space, that's not the right notation, TP of M, are to be the first derivatives So they are supposed to be definable through just the Leibniz rule. And here's the definition in the yellow box. The tangent space, the set of tangent vectors at the point of the manifold M, is the set of derivations of the set of function germs, and I'll define in a sec what derivations means. Namely, it's the set of linear maps, so this is the definition of what the derivations are. It's the set of linear maps, xi, from the set of function germs into R. Namely, the directional derivative takes a function germ and gives you the value of the directional derivative, which is a real number. And the tangent space consists of all those linear maps, which are derivations, which is to say that they obey this Leibniz rule. That is the proper definition of the Leibniz rule for the function germs and the directional derivatives at a point. If you apply the directional derivative to the product of two function germs, or you could also write this as fg and then put a bar over that, then you get the same as if you applied the directional derivative, the tangent vector, onto the first function, or really its function germ, multiplied with the evaluation of the function at the point p, plus you leave the first function the same and simply evaluate it at the point p, and you apply the directional derivative, that is the tangent vector, on the second function there. So it's really just the product rule, but we are being careful here that we evaluate that on function germs, because that's all that the directional derivative at a point can see. Remember, too, that when you evaluate a directional derivative, that is a tangent vector, onto when you evaluate it on a function germ, and you apply the product rule, then the part that's not being differentiated, in this case, this part is not being differentiated. Here, that part is not differentiated. That part is evaluated at the point P in question. And when you evaluate a function germ at a point P, you can drop the bar, because all those functions will have the same value at P, because they have the same value in an open neighborhood, so in particular in P. Okay, so let's remember that property. That's property star. Okay, so why did we go through that trouble of defining the tangent space in this abstract way? Well, this definition is abstract enough, not only for arbitrary differentiable manifolds. I'm actually a little bit getting ahead of myself here, because we haven't really done it for abstract differentiable manifolds just yet. We've only done it for Rn, if you remember. We haven't really even completed the Rn case, but I think I can already explain to you why this is a powerful method. You see, this definition of tangent vectors as derivations of an algebra, so as maps from an algebra into real numbers that obey the Leibniz rule, that definition is also applicable in other notions of geometry. It goes beyond usual differential geometry. For example, there is non-commutative geometry. In this case, there is not really any differential manifold underlying. Differential geometry deals with functions on a manifold where the manifold ceases to exist. This may sound weird, but consider phase space in quantum mechanics. Phase space spanned by the xi and the pi. In quantum mechanics, you have functions of x and p operators as if they were functions on phase space, but phase space doesn't exist in quantum mechanics because the x and the p don't commute. You don't have an R to n. There's no phase space, but you have a well-defined non-commutative algebra of functions on phase space in the sense that you have functions of the x and the p operators. And so you can try to go beyond that and have geometries just like phase space in quantum mechanics, where you don't have manifolds, but you have a leftover of the algebra of functions on the manifold. And that algebra can be non-commutative. But if it's non-commutative, And there is no actual geometric manifold underlying it anymore, just like phase space. Then the geometric definition of tangent space doesn't apply because you don't have paths in phase space, for example. Also, the physicist definition doesn't apply because you don't have coordinate systems in the usual sense. But this definition still applies because now you still have an algebra of functions or function germs. It's just non-commutative now. And you can still define what a derivation is. A derivation being a linear map from the algebra into the real numbers, which obeys the Leibniz rule. So it's a more powerful concept. And on top of that, it doesn't rely on coordinate systems. Because it just says any linear map from this algebra into the real numbers, which obeys this abstract Leibniz rule, is a tangent vector, is a directional derivative. And there is no need to define anything with epsilon going to zero and coordinate systems and coordinate distances and anything of that kind. So let's apply the definition first with a simple example. Manifold M, a point P, and let us consider a constant function and its function germ. So let's say the function x, C of X, so there's the function C, which maps all points of the manifold into R, and it maps those points all into the same number. Let's call that number C. And we call the function as well C. So we are considering a function here which maps all points into the same number C. It's a constant function. This function defines a function germ around the point P, denoted by C bar. And the set of functions in that function germ consists of C itself, but it also consists of functions that are not constant. All they have to do, all that the function has to do to be a member of the germ of C bar is that it is a constant function in an open neighborhood of P, which actually takes the same value as our function C. So if a function is non-constant, but it takes the same value C in an open neighborhood of P, then it is part of that function germ. Okay, so then the proposition is that if we apply the if we apply an arbitrary tangent vector onto that function germ, then we get zero, which is what we would really, really like, because otherwise we're in trouble, right? We want that all directional derivatives of a constant function are zero. And all the other functions in the germ may not be constant, but they are constant in the neighborhood of P. Therefore, really, their functional, their directional derivatives ought to vanish. So the claim is that for all tangent vectors, therefore for all directional derivatives, therefore for all linear maps from the function germs into real numbers that obey the Leibniz rule, this ought to be true. Let's prove this. Let me say something about proofs. We'll do two proofs today. This will be way above average for the other lectures later on. So we'll, it just feels natural that I illustrate some of those concepts now with proofs, but later on in this course, don't worry, I won't bother you too much with tedious proofs. So how do we prove that any directional derivative, any tangent vector defined in the algebraic way, just by virtue of it being a linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule, will obey that condition? Let's see. So we apply the tangent vector, the directional derivative, on this function germ of a constant function. We know by the axiom of linearity, remember there were three axioms for the algebra of function germs. Here they are again. Those three, linearity, and then you can multiply through and you can add as well. By virtue of those, we can pull the number C out of it. See, psi of C times 1 is, we pull the C out of it. So then we have C times psi of 1 times 1. But then we can apply the Leibniz rule. We can differentiate first this one, leaving that the same, plus leaving this the same, and then differentiating that. So we obtain C times psi of 1 plus times 1 plus 1 times psi of 1. But this is twice C times psi of 1, because this is the same as that, so it's twice that. But if you compare, you find that twice C psi of 1 is C psi of 1, and that can only be true if psi of 1 is 0. Okay, so indeed, just by requiring the Leibniz rule and knowing nothing else, we were able to derive that constant functions and their germs are being mapped into 0 by any tangent vector. Now, let's come back to the crucial case where the manifold is Rn. If our definition of the tangent space, if our algebraic definition of the tangent space is any good, then we would expect that it implies that any tangent vector is of this form. Because this is what, from previous studies, we remember a directional derivative to look like. It's partial derivatives with some weight. The weight determines the direction in which you differentiate. So we expect that on Rn, these are the directional derivatives. Therefore, just on the basis of the Leibniz rule and the axioms of the algebra of germs and so on, just on that basis, we should be able to derive that all tangent vectors are of this form. That would be nice. Turns out one can prove that. It's a little tedious, and I'll go through it, but I go through it maybe a little fast. I don't want to spend too much time on it. I want to convey only the message that, indeed, the Leibniz rule on its own is so powerful that it defines everything about derivatives. This is a theme that will come up throughout the course. We will define Lie derivatives, we will define exterior derivatives, all of the machinery that's necessary for differential geometry, and several other kinds of derivatives too. And almost all of them will be defined algebraically, will be defined by virtue of them being some kind of derivation or another, acting on this algebra or another. The advantage always being that we can do this definition without referring to coordinate system. And it's also a definition that these definitions are so general that they might apply even beyond differential geometry. We may have to go beyond differential geometry for quantizing general relativity. So it's good to have the most general tools at hand. Okay, so let's try to prove this. Let's try to prove just on the basis of the basic axioms, like the Leibniz rule, that according to the definition in the yellow box for the tangent vectors, for the tangent space, all tangent vectors take that form. Okay, so without, for the proof, without, that's the second one, and that's the last one today. And you don't really have to follow all details. I mean, I invite you to follow all details, but maybe you don't have to. So for notational convenience, without restricting generality, let us choose P to be, let us choose a chart such that the point P is at the origin. So the point P will have coordinates 0, 0, 0, 0, just to make things simple. Then let's assume psi is a tangent vector according to the definition, the algebraic definition in the yellow box. And let's assume that F is some function on the manifold F bar, it's its function germ around the point P. So this is waiting to be eaten up by that. Let us introduce a notation that we will use throughout the course. It's just a general differential geometric notation. When we have a function of several variables, such as a function h of variables a1 to an, and we want to differentiate this function with respect to the ith variable, then we simply write h comma I. That means partial derivative with respect to the ith variable. So it's really just a shorthand notation for d by d ai of h. See, when you have long expressions that involve lots of partial derivatives, it's much easier to use that notation here, because then you just have a few commas there and a few indices that will do it. So then, with those definitions, let's see. We apply our tangent vectors, our directional derivative, so our abstract element of the tangent space defined in the yellow box. We apply that to this function germ, and this is xi on this. It's trivial because we just added and subtracted something here. And we could also, if we wanted to, write the sum of the three and then put a bar on it by the axioms of the algebra of function germs. Now, by linearity, we can write this as xi of the first part plus xi of the remainder. That's what we do now. So this is xi of the first part. Oh no, I do that in a later step. So we write this as xi of the first part here, and then that we rewrite by the fundamental theorem of calculus in this way. Remember, by the way, that these are not numbers, but this is a constant function, and it generates a function germ. And that function germ also contains functions that are not constant, but they have to agree with the value f of 0 in an open neighborhood of P. Just a reminder. Okay, so by the fundamental theorem of calculus, we can write it in this way. Now, next step. Next step, we use linearity. So we write xi of all of this as xi of that, this piece, plus xi of all of this, where we use the chain rule now. And remember that because of the linearity, you can always do your bars first or bars later. You could, for example, this product of the two, you could also take the product and then put the bar over that. Anyway, so we go from this to this, from that to here, and this expression is vanishing. We proved this just in the previous page, because this is xi of a function germ which is constant. See, f of 0 is a number. It's a constant number. It's putting the bar on it gives you the function germ of generated by a constant function. And as we proved earlier, any directional derivative acting on the germ of a constant function is vanishing. So that term goes away. And we have this thing to deal with. And look how tedious this gets. Just to prove the expectation that the Leibniz rule gives us everything about directional derivatives. Okay, so we have this. So that term goes away. And now we go from this term here. What have we done here? We changed notation. Remember that those partial derivatives can be written simply by commas. This is simply the derivative with respect to the ith variable, so comma I. Same thing, no calculation, just a change of variable. Also, we evaluated that derivative here, d by dt. It just gives us the xi bar. By the way, that's an interesting function germ here. What is that? Xi is the coordinate function. It maps every point of the manifold into the value of the ith coordinate. And that generates a germ. That's what we are talking about here, right? So xi is the coordinate function that maps all the points in the manifold into their ith coordinate. And that's the function germ for that. Okay. Now we use the linearity of the definition of tangent vectors. So we can pull this sum outside, because the direction vector applied to a sum of functions is the sum of the direction vector applied to those functions. So the sum is pulled in front here. And other than that, we kept everything the same. Now we use the Leibniz rule. See, here we have the product of two functions here, This is a function of x. This whole integral here is a function of x, and that's a function of x. Well, more precisely, because there are bars on that, it's function germs. And we have to apply xi to the product of this function and that function. I will not always use the word germ. You understand that it's always implied. But when we have a directional derivative and we have a tangent vector acting on the product of two functions, then we can apply the Leibniz rule. So we have that xi of, we apply xi to the first expression, that thing depends on x, leaving this the same and evaluating it at the point p. And we get another, that's what we have here, xi applied to this first part, and then evaluating that at p. Plus, we leave that thing the same and evaluate it at the point p, and we apply xi, the directional derivative on the second function. That's what we have down here. Luckily, things simplify at this point. The first term has xi applied to this, multiplied with the second function evaluated at p. So xi evaluated on the first term, and now this coordinate function evaluated at p is vanishing, because at the point p the coordinates are zero. We chose them wisely at the beginning. So that whole term goes away. And then we have only to leave this thing the same, but evaluated at the point p, and multiply that with the xi evaluated on the second function. That's here, xi on evaluated on the coordinate function. So we have to evaluate this at the point p, and then we have to evaluate the tangent vector on the coordinate function. The evaluation at the point p is just, I wanted to remind you of that. We had that earlier when we repaired the Leibniz rule. Remember here, that was comment star. The Leibniz rule for tangent vectors acting on function germs is always tangent vector acting on a function germ, taking the second function germ and evaluating it at the point in question. That's the g of p, and then the other way around. So that's what we did here. Okay, so that's what we did here. Okay, so the first term goes away. We're just left with the second term, and that is this. So we have xi evaluated, sorry, I changed the order of the two around. It's a bit more convenient. So xi evaluated on the coordinate function is here, and this thing is carried forward over there. But remember, we have to evaluate it at the point in question, which is x equals 0. So it's just that. But this thing collapses now. It's very simple, because it no longer depends on x. This is just a constant. It's actually just a number. And so we can integrate that up. Remember that when you integrate a number from 0 to 1, integrating a number from 0 to 1, see, it's just that number again. So what we obtain that, remember that this is the partial derivative in the ith direction, I spell it out again, d by dxi of the function evaluated at x equals 0. And here we have those coefficients. This is what we were after. We wanted to show that any linear map from function germs into real numbers that obeys the Leibniz rule is of this form. Coefficients that determine the direction times the partial derivatives. This is a directional derivative. So what we've concluded is that indeed every element of the algebraically defined tangent vector space is of the form xi equal to some coefficients that determine the direction in which things are going times the partial derivatives, an old-fashioned directional derivative. And what are the coefficients xi are that determine the derivative, the direction? We can read it off. It's these. Right? Because this matches that. These are those coefficients. So what we find is that the coefficients of the direction vector are the evaluation. Those numbers are what you get when you evaluate the tangent vector on a coordinate function or its germ. We will encounter that later on, again, the evaluation of a tangent vector on a coordinate function. So what that means is this. If we know how, you know, by linearity, this means that if we know how a tangent vector, how an algebraically defined tangent vector at the point P, acts on the coordinate functions xi and not on any other functions. If we only know how a tangent vector acts on the coordinate functions, well, then we can evaluate this. I mean, to know what the tangent vector does to coordinate functions is to know the xi I numbers. But that means we know what xi does to all functions, right? Because once we have those coefficients xi I, then we have xi. This is the tangent vector. It is going to directionally differentiate now every function you throw at it. So that's an important piece of information. In order to specify what a tangent vector does, you only have to specify what it does to the coordinate functions. That suffices. You could also give other information to specify a tangent vector, but this is a piece of information that suffices. If you know how the tangent vector acts on coordinate functions, then you know how it acts on all functions, because if you know how it acts on coordinate functions, you have the xi I are those coefficients, and altogether this package is just a directional derivative operator that acts on any function that you can, that you want to apply it to. Okay, so now this was a simple example though. This was the simple example of the manifold being Rn. The big test of this approach is whether we can apply this. Also, whether we can apply our definition of tangent space at the point P also for manifolds that are not Rn, for abstract differentiable manifolds, such as our actual space-time. So if you remember, our abstract definition was this, the equation in the box. The tangent space at a point P of a manifold M is given by all those linear maps from the function germs into real numbers, which obey the Leibniz rule. There's no reference to Rn. Okay, so this should go through. Let's see how it does. Okay, so we had the simple example of the manifold being Rn. How does our definition the tangent space work when M is some general manifold? The overall idea is that, yes, we can always use that definition in the yellow box, but it's abstract. We sort of have implicitly defined things, but in order to be able to actually work with those things, we have to boil them down to something that we can parameterize with numbers. So for example, if you remember, we had a differentiable manifold defined abstractly through open sets and relationships between them and so on. But in order to actually be able to work with the points of the manifold, we have to give them names so that we can address them. And so we could give one point the name Sue and the other name Robert and so on, but we would soon run out of names. And the more efficient way to do it is to have a chart that uses as the name of a point n tuplets in Rn. That's why we defined charts. Now similarly, the tangent vectors the vectors in a tangent space need to be addressed somehow. We need to be able to say, this is one, that's another one, and so on. We need to give them names. And how can we give them names? How can we label them? Again, we could give them names like Alice and Bob, but we'd run out of them. So what we can do is we can map the abstract tangent vectors here into concrete tangent vectors to the image point. P has an image over here. And there we have tangent vectors. We do know already, we just established that, how those tangent vectors look like. They have coefficients chi I, if you remember, right? And so we should be able to map the abstract tangent vectors here to tangent vectors over there, and then we can label them. That's the overall idea, to make it tangible, to make the tangent vectors here tangible, to make them labelable, so that we can address them individually. Because in principle, we're already done with the definition in the yellow box that defines everything. What remains to be done is to get a handle on them so that we can actually address them and work with them. So how do we make that abstract tangent space here concrete? And the solution is we make use of charts in a clever way. Now this is going to be abstract and pretty and a little tough if you're not used to this, but we're only going to do this for two lectures, today and on Monday, and then we go into less stormy territory. Okay. Consider the tangent space to a manifold at the point P and so-called diffeomorphisms, right? So diffeomorphisms are differentiable maps from here to there, from one differentiable manifold to another differentiable manifold. Let's say P is a point on the manifold and Q is a point on the manifold N. Later on, we will be mostly interested in the case where N is Rn, so that phi is a chart. And we map abstract points into concrete points of Rn. That's much better. And so that we can then map tangent vectors here, abstract tangent vectors here, into more concretely labeled tangent vectors over there. But for the purposes, for our purposes, it's just as easy or difficult to do it for generic differentiable manifolds here and there. And then we can specialize to N being Rn. So if, remember that if, just keep that in mind, that if N is Rn, then phi is just a chart. But in general, it's not a chart. Okay, so now here's the pretty picture. Imagine you have a manifold with a point P, and has a diffeomorphism into another manifold N, where P is mapped into the point Q. Of course, the neighboring points are mapped into neighboring points over there. But our focus is on the point P. Now, it turns out that a diffeomorphism from M to N induces a map from the space of, from the algebra, of function germs around the point Q to the algebra of function germs around the point P. And it is an algebra homomorphism, which means that the structure of the algebra is preserved. Whether you take two function germs and multiply them first and then map them, or you take the two function germs, map them, and then multiply them, same result. This is what it means to have an algebra homomorphism. Homomorphism meaning same structure. But why on earth is this arrow going that way? What I'm saying is that a diffeomorphism this way is mapping the function germ. You see, I should really plot this on top of that, right? This function, this algebra of function germs is sitting at this point. And that algebra of function germs is sitting at that point, right? But it would look messy, so I just drew them separately. Okay, so the claim is that if you have a diffeomorphism from that manifold to that manifold, it induces automatically an algebra homomorphism from the algebra of germs here to the algebra of germs over there. How? Does anybody see why the arrow is reversed? See, oh, is it still open the door? Yeah. So how does this algebra homomorphism work? Imagine you have an element of this function space, or function space of, an element of this space of functions, this equivalence class of functions, the function germ. Think of it as a function. Let's just keep it simple with the language. So there's a function g, which lives on that manifold. How can we map that function into a function over there? So you have a function over here. It's a function that lives on that manifold. How can we map that into a function on that manifold? There's a canonical way to do this. So if you have a function g that lives on that manifold, so it feeds on points in here, and it spits out numbers, for example, then we can turn that into a function that lives on here, which takes as input points here and spits out numbers. Namely, we take our function here, and we prepend that diffeomorphism. So originally, it's a function here, but we turn it into a function on the points there by prepending that. So you have a function here, the g, and it becomes a function in this set, a function on that map, by taking any input point here, mapping it via the diffeomorphism into this manifold, and now you can feed it in the function. That composite function of the diffeomorphism and then the original function here, that composite function is a function that lives on here. So therefore, for any function that lives on here, we can automatically get a function that lives on here. That's this map. It maps functions on this side to functions on that side. And that's an algebra homomorphism, as you can easily convince yourself by just checking the axioms there. So so we have this map. So the diffeomorphism is called phi. Then phi star is an algebra homomorphism that maps functions on in the space of germs here to functions in the space of germs over there. Let's write it down in formulas. So f of q and f of p are the spaces of the algebra of function germs, the algebras of function germs. And phi is the diffeomorphism. Phi star is mapping from this algebra into that algebra. And it's doing it by doing this. Phi star maps a function in this set into a function f in that set, which is called phi star of g, in such a way that the image function f evaluated on x is given by take the point x, then use phi to map it into a point in the second manifold n, and then apply the original function g on that. See, so you take x, use x is in here, with phi you move it over there, you get the image of x, phi of x, and then you plug that output point into the function g, you get a number, and that's the number that f, by definition, is outputting. In other words, the image of g is called f, and it is simply phi, and then little circle here, which means concatenation, the output of phi is used as input in g. Okay, so you see why it is natural that a map in this direction induces a diffeomorphism in this direction, induces an algebra homomorphism in the opposite direction. What if we did this again? And now we define a map on those. No, it's just like these are maps on those. These are maps on those. You know, there are functions on that. So they map this into something else. If we did this again, we look at functions on those, evaluations on those. Then we should expect that the error reverses again. Yes, this happens. So we have the diffeomorphism that maps this manifold into this manifold. This induces algebra homomorphism that way. But now look at the at the tangent vectors. Tangent vectors are maps on those. You see, a tangent vector feeds on an element of a function germ and outputs a number. So it takes these as input and outputs a number. And the tangent vectors here take those as output. They take those as inputs and outputs a number. You know, it takes a tangent vector takes a function or function germ as input, and it outputs the directional derivative, which is a number. So by the same arguments as before, namely by concatenation, we have that this map induces a map now from that tangent space into this tangent space. And this is now a linear map, because this tangent space is a vector space, that tangent space is a vector space, the map in between them, which is structure preserving, is a linear map. This map is called TP phi, not to be confused with TP of M. TP of M is the tangent space, but TP phi, where phi is a diffeomorphism, is the map that maps tangent vectors into tangent vectors. So overall, the upshot of this is that when we have two differentiable manifolds and a diffeomorphism between the two, then the diffeomorphism phi will induce an algebra homomorphism in the opposite direction, but it will induce a linear map, which is a vector space homomorphism, just another way of saying that, in the original direction of the diffeomorphism. This is great, because if you remember, later on, this will be an abstract differentiable manifold. This will be Rn. And just like the points in Rn will serve as names for the points in the differentiable manifold, down here, this will be the abstract tangent vector space to an abstract points in the abstract differentiable manifold, whereas this is the tangent vector space to a point in Rn. And tangent vectors to a point in Rn are specified or labeled by n numbers, the coefficients xi I. Therefore, we have, again, names for the elements of the abstract tangent vector space over there. Just like the coordinates provide names for the points, the tangent vectors here, and in particular their coefficient numbers, can provide names for the elements of the abstract tangent space over there. And as I said, just by concatenation, so the image of a tangent vector, xi is a tangent vector here, the image of it is obtained by taking the map earlier, this map, and concatenating it with, concatenating it with xi. Right, so this thing maps function germs into numbers. This will also, the eta, its image, will also map function germs into numbers, but it will map those function germs into numbers. How does it do it? Well, you take a function germ here, map it over there, and then apply xi to it. That maps it onto a number. This is, overall, a map from those functions into real numbers, therefore an element of this. So, just as before, the arrows are reversed, and that's what we have. So the crucial special case that we'll be interested in mostly, at least for these purposes now, is where the second differentiable manifold, the one on the right, is Rn, where phi is an invertible map, it's a chart, then phi star is an algebra isomorphism. By the way, phi is not invertible, that is not going to be an algebra isomorphism. Homomorphism. Then, in this case, TP of phi is a vector space isomorphism. It's a linear map between, an invertible linear map between the tangent spaces on the left and on the right. The tangent space to the point P and the tangent space to the point Q on the other manifold. So, as we said just a few minutes ago, we do obtain a concrete handle on the abstract tangent vectors if we're given a chart. So now, it's the same picture as above, it's just we specialize here to Rn. We have a diffeomorphism, in this case it's a chart because it maps into Rn. This labels the points of the manifold, therefore algebra homomorphism. We have this map, and so by pointing out, by choosing a particular tangent vector here, tangent vector to a point in Rn, we are implicitly pointing out also a tangent vector in here because of that map. And one-to-one correspondence. Again, for the notation, keep in mind that TP phi is that map. It's the name of that map. It's a tangent map. Mapping tangent vectors on one manifold to tangent vectors on the other manifold. Whereas this notation here, TP of M, when the whole manifold is in there, it simply means the tangent space of the point P of the manifold M. This is, even though it also has a capital T and a subscript P, is a totally different thing. This is mapping, it's a linear map from one tangent space to another tangent space. Okay, so I think I'm repeating myself here. Given a charge phi, are we doing time? Yes, Gil.
Sometimes people call these maps like pullbacks and push forwards, and I always get mixed up.
Yes, we will get to all the nomenclature once we have everything together. Yeah. Given a charge phi, every abstract point P now has a concrete image, and the tangent vectors also now have concrete images. So every abstract vector psi in the tangent space to an abstract point P of the manifold now has a concrete image in the tangent space to a point in Rn. And those guys have a description in terms of explicit coefficients psi I. Namely, we showed that any such tangent vector to a point in Rn is given in this way. Remember, that was this long, tedious proof that every tangent vector to a point in Rn takes this form. It's a linear combination of partial derivatives with some weight coefficients. And those weight coefficients, we can run through all those weight coefficients, and it will give us the entire tangent space to a point. And by running through all possible etas, we are running through all possible tangent vectors to an abstract point in the abstract manifold as well. And this is just saying that the reverse is also possible. So assuming a fixed diffeomorphism between a manifold and Rn, any choice of point in the coordinate system in Rn denotes a point in the manifold, and any choice of those coefficients, eta 1 to eta n, denotes a point in the tangent space. I think, same thing. It goes the other way around too, because we are assuming that it's a chart, that it's a invertible differentiable map. So choosing something on the side of the concrete Rn implies choosing something on the abstract side and vice versa. We will therefore often use that as a shorthand notation. So if you've chosen a chart, then you can map any abstract tangent vector to a point on the abstract manifold into something concrete in Rn. And then you have this kind of representation for your abstract tangent vectors. And sometimes it will be convenient to use that notation even before choosing a chart. We will just write the abstract vectors in this form, even if we don't choose actually a chart. This we can only do, of course, if it's not confusing. If it is at some point confusing, then do point it out to me and I will clarify it. But it's just a shorthand thing that we often identify the abstract with the concrete without spelling out exactly which map, which coordinate system we choose for that. Now that we have a map between the abstract tangent vectors, this is just a preparation for what we do then on Monday. We will do the physicist. The first thing we will do on Monday is do the physicist definition of tangent space, which is to identify tangent vectors by their transformation behavior of the coefficients. And clearly, we are in the right position for this now, because we have a map from abstract tangent vectors into concrete tangent vectors to points in Rn. And if we change chart, if we now change to a new diffeomorphism, a new map from the abstract manifold into Rn. Then we get a new coordinate. We have a new coordinate system. We get a new association, a new mapping of abstract tangent vectors into coefficients in Rn. This is what we are. This is what is colloquially known as a change of coordinates, and we can then calculate what the transformation behavior of the coefficients is going to be from this abstract perspective. So we will see that this definition, the algebraic definition of tangent vectors, includes the physicist's definition as well. But as we will see later, we can do more with this. Okay, so we're done for today. Any questions? Well, if not, oh, there's one.
I was just wondering, if you're more business, just bijection, right?
Yeah.
So are all smooth manifolds have bijection with each other? Is that true?
No, the dimension has to match.
There's no set dimension matches.
Yes, but it, more than that, the topology also has to match. It's a non-trivial thing. In fact, there's a whole theory that tries to answer your question. If you're given two differentiable manifolds, can you smoothly deform them into each other? Is there a, you know, can you change them in a diffeomorphic way into each other? And then if they have some manifolds you can, some you cannot, not in a smooth way. So for example, they can have holes and handles, and that would be an obstruction. And the theory of homology and cohomology addresses exactly that question. And this is structure before you even put curvature onto a manifold. The so-called topological structure.
Yep. Do we deal with mostly diffeomorphisms in this course?
Yes, yes. We will encounter singularities, of course, with general relativity. But that's a different story. So that's the worst that will happen. Generally, we will assume that the manifolds are differentiable and therefore smooth.
Because you can run into some problems with some of the coordinate stuff today.
Yes. Yes. But we do not expect that that comes up in physics. Yeah. I mean, it is space-time, well, at least is very well described as a differentiable manifold. And there's no evidence that it's not differentiable. And that, yeah. Okay, then have a nice weekend. Oh, there's one more.
So when we define the function germs, we're always talking about some open set of which P is a member. So it's true that every function, say you have function F and it generates a germ, every other element of the germ is exactly equal to that function F on some open neighborhood.
On some open neighborhood, yeah.
Which means that in the case of a constant function, every function in the germ must also have vanishing derivative in a neighborhood of P as
correct.
Well, right?
Correct. But remember that the functions don't have to be analytic. So that doesn't determine their overall behavior.
Right.
If they had to be analytic, then of course, if you know them on an interval, you know them everywhere. But they don't have to be.
So this will be true only for functions which are not entire functions.
No, it includes entire functions.
No,
it's just that
in
the
that
entire
case, it will just be at a point. The germ will be reduced to a point in case of entire functions.
Well, entire functions are not excluded. They are included among the other functions. It's just that entire functions have this property that if you know what they do on an interval, you know what they do everywhere.
So in that case, either the germ will have just one function, or there are many functions.
Well, if you were to define germs in a restricted way as only applying to entire functions, if your entire function space consists only of entire functions, then the whole thing would collapse. Yeah,
right.
And it makes no sense to go to germs.
But in that case, you could be defined at a point. At a point, there could be many different functions, which are entire functions, but which
yes.
coincide at one point, but not in a
Yes, but that wouldn't be in the spirit of defining germs, because they require that the functions agree on an open neighborhood, which means that in particular, if they are smooth, then they agree on all derivatives. So therefore, the Taylor expansions agree, and so on.
But in the case of space-time, once differentiable is the same as entire, right?
for the manifold itself, but not for functions on the manifold. Functions on the manifold might be CK. It might be 5 times differentiable, but not more. Yeah. Okay, then. Have a nice weekend. See you on Monday.